Okay, we're on tape three, side A. July 24th, 1986, 7:30 approximately in the evening after a break. Okay, we're talking
about...
Yes, go ahead.
The point about full interpretation is that most scientists miss a very simple one. You got to know what you're looking at. You got to know the name of it before you can interpret it. You can't figure anything out from a picture by itself, illustration. Suppose I buy a World War II surplus aerial camera. I fly over Dayton, Ohio at 5,000 feet and I get a picture with this on it. I show a truncated triangle. And I go and give this picture to an interpreter from the Royal New Zealand Air Force. Well, for purposes of this illustration, we'll say it's never been out of New Zealand. I say, Jock, what's this? And he will say, I don't know what the hell it is. I say, well, let me explain it to you. It's an outdoor movie theater. When the lights go out, when the sun sets, and you're not able to be there with your camera because the sun has set, the lights go out, the sandbox is filled with playing kids, hot dogs are sold here, and the screen projects here. Cars come in, and when the movie's over, it all disappears, and it looks like it looks in this picture, dead. He says, I got it. Now he'd be able to recognize this at 1/10,000th the amount of information. I was on a picture this size of probably 500,000 bits of information, at least 100,000 or so. So you never figured it out, because he's out of phase with this problem. He goes over there at high noon, the thing can't work. It requires it to be dark for it to work. Well, we got all kinds of gadgets like that in the Soviet Union. Not outdoor movie theaters, but other things which don't match our cycle of observation and so forth.
Cultural differences in styles of building and styles of ground planning and layout and things like that.
Sure, they don't have to show us anything if they don't want to show it to us. They ship missiles in container tubes. We don't see the missiles, we see these tubes. We don't know if there's a missile in there or not. They may have stored it in the building. In my booklet on verification, I got an illustration of this. So I'll let you read that and come back to me with some questions.
Mm-hmm. How well developed was this awareness of the need for the interpreter to bring a whole wealth of knowledge to the interpretation? How well developed was this, say, when you were at Wright?
It's pretty well developed. Interpreters are remarkable people. The British had an interpreter. The British used women for interpreters quite a bit. And I knew one of them slightly, Jock Holliday's wife. She was an expert on world shipping. And she knew the name of every ship in the world, just about. Every freighter knew where it was coming, where it was going, everything. Just from looking at pictures continuously and specializing in that one subject. I hope I haven't got the story wrong, but that's as I recall it. Mm-hmm. There are about 20,000 ships that she knew about. Now, you've got to realize there's all kinds of contextual information, as I mentioned earlier. When you say that, if a ship's one day in the Atlantic, the next day the Pacific's one just like her, you know it isn't the same ship, because it can't make that jump that fast.
Mm-hmm.
So context and staying with the subject and day after day making note of changes helps. It's hard to camouflage a ship completely. It's easy to hide a submarine.
Mm-hmm.
Just go down and duck under.
Now, your area and your job in the both at Wright and then later at Rand really didn't have to do with what photo interpreters did with the materials that you helped supply. I mean, your goal was fairly simple.
Yes,
greater resolution.
Right.
Better ability to perform under various kinds of hostile conditions, vibrations, altitude, varying atmospheric conditions, and so forth.
Although
is that fair
in Korea, yes.
To say?
That's fair. had an experience in Korea, which was interesting. I had some time on my hands there. I didn't know what I was there for. I was called for by MacArthur. At least a telegram said MacArthur. But then we realized afterwards every telegram that comes out of the Far East was signed MacArthur. Even a request for toilet paper. So I was involved with the Incheon landing. Had a problem which we solved nicely. But I spent some time with the interpreters of the 8th TAC Recce Squadron, which was situated in Itazuki, I-T-A-Z-U-K-E, Air Force Base, near the town of Fukuoka, F-U-K-O-K-A, something like that, Fukuoka. And I spent some time with them, and not one of those guys wanted to be there. All four were on the way home, more or less, when they were drafted. One guy was on a ship going by, leaving the Philippines. He went down and hid in the boiler room, so he couldn't find them. Because he knew he was going to be called back to Korea, which he just left when war started, that is. There were four photo interpreters. And I occupied myself with dumb questions like this. How long does it take to interpret a picture? I think that's a straightforward question. They accused me of being a dummy and worse. And they were right because they said, see this room? And the room was maybe twice or three times the size of the room we're in right now. Pictures come in from the door at that end, they got to go out the door at the other end. We have no storage facility, we got to interpret everything that comes in. If twice as much came in, we'd interpret it twice as fast. So you take the number of carrier planes that support in that operation, 18, roughly, 18 or 20 airplanes, let's say, four cameras per airplane, 80 cameras, each one carrying an average of 300 feet of film. That's 400 pictures, roughly. So you multiply this all together, and you got the number of pictures divided by four interpreters, you got the number per day, divided by the number of hours, and you get the number per hour, and so forth. So the speed was determined by the volume, which is crazy. But that's how it was.
Yet at the same time, I imagine you could spend an infinite amount of time on one picture.
That's right. If you calculate the information on a picture, well, perhaps 100 million bits of information on a normal, high-quality 10-by-10 picture or so. And then if you divide by the maximum information rate possible, which is 23 bits per second, there's a guy named Questar at the University of Illinois who did some experiments back in the 50s, did some experiments with high-speed typing, high-speed music reading, and he got maximum information rate is 23 bits per second, some number like that. If you take 23 bits per second, divide it into 100 million bits, because you can't interpret a picture in your lifetime. But that's the wrong answer also. Clearly what you're doing is something else altogether. You're not dividing one number by the other number when you're looking at pictures. You're doing gestalt analysis somehow.
And you also have a purpose.
You
always have a purpose in looking at these things. And the same picture 20 years later with a different purpose can yield new information.
It's interesting. Every time there's a scientific body convened to study the problems of photo interpretation or analysis or photography, they always come up with the same invention, the blink comparator. Take a picture one day, take a picture the next day, put them in a stereoscope and blink one on top of the other, and pretty soon you see changes manifest themselves. Which is great for finding stars that weren't there the day before, but lousy for doing this, because you can never get the same lighting on two pictures, never the same altitude. By the time you fuss around, you've lost the game.
Of all the work that you did at Wright through World War II, what particular invention or innovation or gadget did you find most challenging?
Interesting question. I never thought about that. perhaps the advent of high resolution, which comes up, leads me to a very interesting point. I maintain that we went from World War resolution of 10 lines per millimeter on the average to easy 100 lines per millimeter these days with special cameras and special handling and so on. 100 lines per millimeter or higher. That we old-timers ought to get the hell off the stage. But we're so impressed with that accomplishment that we can't believe we can do much better. Whereas somebody, kids coming in today, they think PAR is 100 lines per millimeter. We think that 10 to 100 lines is PAR. So they start with present achievements as given. They're ready to make improvements. Whereas we struggle to get up to that level, just soon sit there for a while and enjoy 100 lines per millimeter, which is quite a fantastic sharp picture, by the way.
Did Goddard appreciate the technical challenges?
Yeah. Before he became a non-compos mental, he's in a rest home now and doesn't know who his friends are and doesn't know anything anymore. He's about 95 years old now. Jeez. I've stayed in close touch with him all this time. Before that, we arranged for him to get caught up on the latest developments in reconnaissance. And he said after that one day, he said that's the best day of his life. Want him to see what happened before he shuffled off this mortal coil, as expression goes. He thought it only right that he be brought up to speed and see what happened, what his kids did for him, and what happened. And he appreciated that.
Was he more impressed at the time that you were working for him? Was he more impressed by results, or did he appreciate more what went into producing the results? Sometimes an enormous amount of effort is necessary for a tiny result, and sometimes a great result comes out of almost
an interesting experiment, interesting experience in that way. The strip camera was used by Goddard for lectures. We documented aerial destruction in Europe and in Japan with a strip camera. And the way it was done was this. We took side obliques. Here's the airplane flying this way. Strip camera's pointing out the side. That's the angle covered by the slit. There's this narrow slit here, two rolls of film. One take up, one receiving. The trouble is that this camera works fine when it's pointed straight down and all the images are proceeding at the same speed through the aperture. When you take a side oblique, the scale is different from one front to back. And so small scale stuff goes at slower speed than high speed stuff. That results when you project it in stereo, you take this in stereo, you get curved images. And it looks like you're looking at a crazy thing that looks like this. So he offered, he went around the country hollering, I'll give a $25,000 contract to anybody who can figure out how to solve this. I solved it, and all he got out, I got out of him was a steak dinner. Because I realized that you point the camera out the side, and this is the slit, let's say, it's looking out the side. The image is going to sail through here like mad and be stretched at the foreground and stretched at the top, which is the top upside down, and compressed at the bottom. And you want a street image as a straight line. So I propose that we take the camera and cant the slit over to an angle like this. For a top camera and for another one, taking the steer the other way. So that street sails through there, the image is going like this. Now it's going like this. at high speed. Mm-hmm. So if you captured, you got a straight line, you captured a straight line. It's a fundamental requirement for good imaging. The trouble is nobody knows what happened to all that film. Marvel's documentation showed this destruction up close, and color, and big. Not miniature slides, but 9-inch film. It all seems to have disappeared. Mm. Nobody stole it. It's just the organization.
Yeah.
Such a dissolve that. And what happened to all the slides we used to have in the photo lab? And the pictures? Negatives? It's all gone. Some guy came in with a broom and swept it out.
That brings up one thing that we did want to discuss with you, and that is the kinds of materials that you still have. You've showed us some slides.
Yes.
That you have, and a large variety of large format photographs, such as the one that we discussed.
Yes.
Earlier today. I was wondering if you could just sort of describe what sorts of photographic materials you have.
Yeah, we're happy to do that. We're happy to donate this stuff to you fellows if you give me a slight assurance that it won't be thrown out when it gets to Washington.
Oh, well, we want to... not a chance. We want to get a description of this so we can discuss it with our colleagues and let them know what's potentially available.
I've got...
And assure that there is a place for it, which I'm sure there is.
I've got some pictures of the Incheon beaches. Let me describe what that was. On September 1st, 1950, I was called in to go down and talk to the Navy about the problem they had about invading Incheon, which was scheduled for about the 15th. And the problem was very straightforward. Incheon's got huge tides, 27, 30 feet tides. And if your landing craft is up against the wall, and the tide goes out, it's stuck there in the mud, and everybody can take pot shots at it like crazy. So that's a very bad thing to do, be stuck in the mud. And when the tide went out at Incheon, it went out for about 2-3 miles. And so they want to know how long how high the walls are at various stages of the tide, what kind of ladders they'll need, all that. We solved the problem very nicely. I wrote a paper about that, which if I can find it, I'll mail you a copy. And we solved the problem. We got it within... we asked the Navy to measure the walls after the invasion, let us know how good we did. And they gave measurements X. And then I had an Air Force Colonel, Oscar Johnson, which my lab was assigned over there. I had him measure the walls in certain places, and he got Y, and our measurements were right in between these two spot measurements, which was pretty damn good. We delivered the pictures to the Navy, and the Marines, these pictures were taken by airplanes flying right into the wall, as it were. Walls here, Red Beach, and then Blue Beach somewhere else. And when the Marines saw the pictures, they said that's just what they need for landing craft. This gives them a kind of sequence as they come into the wall. They know where they are, where they're going. So that works fine. I've got those pictures, the originals, right here. That is original prints. Somebody's got the original negatives. These are original prints right off the negatives. And I've got lots of pictures of various events, like in a Tet Offensive in Vietnam, show what was going on, sample pictures. The pictures I showed you earlier came out of a big envelope, 9x18s, are examples of 100-inch focal-length photography from high altitude, examples of image motion compensation with and without image motion compensation, selected prints taken by Baker's lenses, and all that. And I've got several sets of that. There's a big stash up on top of the chest there.
That stuff's very important.
Yeah, and what we would want to do is at some point when we put these into the collection, to have you describe, we'll assign numbers to them, have you describe each and every one so that there is a information about them, about what it is and yes, what it relates to, so that they'll make sense to somebody 100 years from now, yes, whenever. So you have slides, and then there are these prints and negatives.
I don't have negatives.
You don't have negatives, just prints. Prints and slides.
Prints and slides.
Okay. As far as your papers, what kinds of papers have you saved? We've seen that you have notebooks.
Yes.
And for instance, have you retained your correspondence over the years?
Yes, I've been throwing it out lately because I just am choked with correspondence. In a far corner of that bookcase, the lower left-hand corner, mm-hmm, there's some stuff dating from before World War II and through the war.
And we would encourage you to sort of think twice about throwing correspondence. Oh, that's usually a very valuable historical documentation.
Yes. I had to throw it out. I've been carrying, packing, and pack ratting around the country for years now. Mm-hmm. It comes to the point where it's just choking me.
Well, we can leave
every, you... Every one of these one of these cabinet doors is full. This drawer is a book I'm trying to write. On bureaucratic humor.
Oh, we need it. We need that desperately. Well, we can see if I have a package with me. You can travel with... But we can leave you self-addressed postage paid labels that if you feel you really must get rid of correspondence, if you were going to throw it out, if you wouldn't mind packing it in a box and
be happy to
these
do
labels are postage paid, it'll come right to us and we can hold it for the archives. Because what we were saying earlier, what we like to do is to try to keep an individual's papers together, if possible. And I realize that there's a lot of materials that you continue to use, but whatever materials that you no longer need, we would be happy to take.
Fine.
And you could, of course, have access to them whenever you wanted. You could, if you need to look something up,
find easier to find when you're filing.
Need a file or need a folder or something like that. We do this all the time with various people.
Good. I'll be going through most of this stuff in the next few months, and I'll come across an item that's of interest to you. I'll put it aside, and we'd like to get a stack of them and mail them out.
Okay.
The story of high resolution is extremely interesting. How we got that way, because all the effort up to that point was saying that we were just at the plateau, we got 28 lines per millimeter, 30 lines per millimeter, something like that. And that's the best we're ever going to do, because look where we were in World War II, 10 lines, and this is it. And in the spring of 54, Jim Baker was by that time chairman of the intelligence panel and assigned to the advisory board. He and I made a trip to Europe together to look at the problems. And when we did, he came back thoroughly impressed with the lousy light conditions in Europe. The fog, the haze, the low contrast. He started experimenting in his basement. He had a huge house at the time.
Yes.
With a 40-foot by 70-foot basement. You heard about this one?
I've heard about his house.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Every day somewhere in that house a bulb was burning out. place bulbs every day. His house was 40 by 70 by three stories up, one story down. That's big. Not as big as Buckingham Palace, but big. He had a marvelous lab in a basement. And he ran an experiment like this. He had a target here, which consisted of all kinds of screwball target shapes, ships and airplanes and letters, jumbled in various orientation, on a big sheet that, as I recall now, is at least 3 feet square, or maybe even bigger. Down the other end of the basement, he had his lens he's testing. And he introduced light into this. Putting a split piece of glass right there and throwing light in on top of the screen, reducing the contrast. He's looking this way through the whole apparatus. And he found that with a certain film, contrast pan, Eastman's film, he could take pictures and see these objects clearly when he couldn't see them visually at all. He could sit back here with the eyeball looking through this piece of plain glass, and the contrast is so reduced that it's below the visual threshold, which is 2% or something like that. So then he discovered he could take pictures anyway. Now, the only reason he experimented with that film, which was the wrong film for an experiment with, he misread the speed of the film. And the speed of the film was actually much lower than he read. He was off by a factor of 10. He wouldn't have ever tried that film if he didn't know how slow it was. But he tried the film, and the next question was, getting film faster, high contrast? And that started the whole ball of wax. Mm-hmm. I was going to tell you a story about Garuzzo with a G. We're going to go off the record here.
And how that might have fit into your work.
Continuing again. Okay. So we wanted to ask you, you mentioned just mentioned your work with V2s a little while earlier, and we were wondering if you could expand on that.
We installed a camera in a Viking rocket, not a V2. Viking came a little later. I forget what the purpose of that thing was. It may have been simply to get pictures from as high altitude as we could get, which was pretty good. And that's the first picture in my paper on satellites. And an amazing thing is demonstrated in this picture.
This is the Astronautics series.
Yes.
And on page 2 of the first article, the Viking rocket picture.
Here's El Paso. Hell of a time making out El Paso there, but that's El Paso. Here's the rail line. You see that line?
Mm-hmm.
Going north to Alamogordo. Now, an amazing thing happens. Avert your eyes for a moment while I do something.
Okay.
All right, where's the railroad?
I can't see it.
See it now?
It's right about there.
Yes. shows that calculations of what you can see, what you can resolve, are not valid when you're dealing with objects other than the kind you make your tests on. Long lines are always resolved because you're picking up information all up that line. And when I deny you the information with this card, it disappears. And obviously it doesn't disappear, it's just as much there now as it was before.
The ability to see the so-called canals on Mars was one instance in which people invoked that explanation, that very faint, long lines, even though below the theoretical limit of resolution, were nonetheless visible.
Yes, that's why we see telephone lines on pictures that don't have resolution anywhere approaching that.
So when you never did put cameras on V2s.
I don't recall doing that.
You were not brought in on the V2.
No.
But you were asked to put a camera on the Viking.
Yes, we put a camera on it. It was a crappy camera, a K-25, which was the motorized version of the 4x5 handheld camera that the Air Force had in all its airplanes. It had a handheld camera to see something to take a picture of. Take it up and take a picture, crank the handle. And this was a motorized version.
And who asked you to put the camera on the Viking?
I don't know if we originated that suggestion ourselves or not. Mm-hmm. All kinds of ways of making a suggestion. You start a paper and it goes up to the laboratory, out, and goes somewhere, and somebody says, okay, and more likely somebody will say, not okay. That's much more likely.
Was there ever any thought to use rockets operationally to carry out high-altitude photography? Would there have been anything to gain?
Nothing.
Above use of an airplane or a balloon?
Yeah, when you stop to think about it, where are you going to launch this rocket? You can go straight up. It's going to come down someplace where, not in Europe, it's too crowded. And we thought about it. The resolution wasn't good enough. It wasn't until we got this panoramic camera working in a balloon that we saw the era of high resolution dawn on us. That's that flat camera that you've got in the balloon exhibit.
In the gallery there.
So the kinds of photographs, say, that were taken by NRL with the V2, you didn't really see fitting into your interests because they really weren't working towards that goal of high resolution. They were really more just kind of attempts to see what would happen, as I understand it.
Well, I was at Wright Field. I didn't know anything about NRL.
Okay, so you didn't have much interaction with colleagues there?
No. First place, the Navy is always difficult to work with. The Navy is autonomous. It's a country unto itself. The Air Force and the Army get along more or less. But the Navy doesn't do business with anybody. They're like Eastman Kodak. He's changed ambassadors.
Did they have your counterparts working along similar lines?
In the Navy?
In the Navy.
Not to my knowledge. I don't think they did.
How did they get their photography or their charts?
Their charts were made by the Naval Hydrographic Office. The basic photography was taken by probably the Air Force. This is a very confusing subject. Mm-hmm. At one time I had it straight, just for a fleeting moment. That passed a long time ago. A chart is a map made for the Air Force. A map is a chart made for the Army.
Yes. What did the Navy use?
They used hydrographic charts, which look like Air Force charts.
But they didn't have a parallel effort, to the best of your knowledge, going on along the same lines. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about the period before you joined RAND and after the war. Besides the balloon panoramic camera and the high resolution work in the balloons, what other kinds of things did you work on?
Well, in 52, Colonel Dick Leghorn was called back into service at the time of Korea, so he was on duty in 52 in Washington. He had an effort called the Development Planning Objective, where I met some RAND guys, Andy Marshall, Bert Klein. And he was looking at the survey of future reconnaissance and to some extent intelligence. And this activity went on for months. It followed the work of the Beacon Hill Committee. Had you heard of that?
What was the Beacon Hill Committee?
It was a group of scientists studying reconnaissance. It's had guys like Ed Land, Purcell, Harvard physicist, Baker. The leader was a guy named Carl Overhaeg.
How do you spell that?
Over, H-A-G-E. I think it was from Eastman. A number of others. And they looked at this field of reconnaissance carefully. Field of lens design, image formation, and studied good. And after that project, which ran through the summer of 52, it was this development planning objective thing, which looked hard at reconnaissance activities and was the most progressive force in the Air Force. We're looking at the future of the subject. It's important to notice that this activity didn't produce a report for several years. It cycled through several chiefs of the office. After Leghorn, it was a Colonel Smiley, and then Colonel Johnson had it for a while, and maybe one or two others. But the activity of getting all these disparate guys together, I didn't say desperate, I mean disparate, and talking about problems of intelligence and overflight and all that, it set the stage for the U-2. U-2 didn't come out of no place. It came out of a systematic laying on of requirements. You read Leghorn's papers in there, that blue book on readings and reconnaissance, you'll see how the subject developed. I have an extensive file of correspondence by Leghorn here. Here's a paper of his solution to the strategy model. This year I have a letter from Leghorn dated February 22nd, 1949. Dr. Compton, Carl Compton. This note is to thank you for the opportunity you gave me last week to discuss with you informally views on the need to guide the application of more American technology to the intelligence problem in the military establishment through some group or committee specifically organized for the purpose. That's a difficult sentence. As I mentioned to you, I saw Mr. Alan Dulles in New York the afternoon of our discussion. I believe it is appropriate to mention the opinion he expressed, the effect that the most important problem of intelligence today is to get American science technology more into the picture?
That's a classic statement.
Yeah, it's a mechanical statement. But 49 is a little early. We weren't looking at her excitement in 49.
So, you worked with the Beacon Hill Committee?
I worked with the Beacon Hill Committee. I worked with Leghorn's DPO in Washington for a while.
And was this a kind of an assessment of where surveillance stood, or where the overall realm of intelligence stood, and how all technologies could be used to systematically benefit the gathering of intelligence?
Focused on imaging intelligence.
Imaging intelligence.
Very specific. And you too came out of that.
Okay.
Not specifically in that form. We didn't design the airplane.
But as a requirement for some platform.
Yeah.
From which to gather such imaging and intelligence.
That's important because my impression is that SAC was quite happy with the status quo. They didn't need any new photo intelligence because they were treading or going around in a circle. Here they're bombers. They knew where the cities were, they thought. So cities became targets. And they was targeting the industrial plant, they didn't know where Allen was. Or military bases, they didn't know where those were. But cities they could find. So they didn't state, they didn't say we're in trouble, we have a deficiency in our plans. We'd like to have different plans. Or target limited. We're going around in a circle.
So they said we will go after the cities, make the cities the targets.
Right.
And since we can find the cities, we don't need any.
There's a paper I wrote for RAND, which I don't have a copy of. History of Psi-Look and Radar for Reconnaissance Purposes. Psi-Look and Radar was invented by Dick Philbrick. This colonel, based on a strip camera, he argued if you could make an electronic antenna work like the slit in a strip camera, flying along. And so he took the APQ-7, which was called the Eagle. I don't know how the hell I remember this stuff. I can't remember who I talked to yesterday. APQ-7 was called the Eagle, and it was about a 12-foot antenna, linear antenna. So I put out a pulse this way, and that was like the slit in the strip camera.
Mm-hmm.
It just to find its own narrow thing, and you move along, images on film, transferred to film, and move your film with strip camera film, magazine, and you've got a reconnaissance gadget. Now, nobody was interested in that. Three main components of the Air Force were uninterested in this, were hostile to it. SAC, Headquarters Intelligence, and the radar lab at Wright Field. It's crazy. It's like a guy telling me the three things he's not interested in, photography, airplanes, and cameras. The reason intelligence wasn't interested in this, they wanted anything new. They have to have interpreters. They didn't have interpreters. The interpreters they had didn't know about this radar. The radiation lab at Wright Field didn't want this thing because they didn't invent it. They're not working for the photo lab. So we changed them to the aerial reconnaissance lab. Get off this photo limitation. See what else didn't want it. Intelligence, SAC. SAC didn't want their maps, their target charts being made by a radar I was the one they were going to use for bombing, which is crazy.
They didn't want their charts being made by a radar other than the one they were, the type that was going to be on, in their planes.
Yeah.
For the bombing.
It's a goddamn dummy, can't begin to attack it. That was some severe handicaps.
We just flipped the tape over here. We're getting to the end of side A. We'll go to side B.